You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the chaotic aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, people with the task of serving and protecting citizens ended up by being charged with killing them instead. New Orleans police officers shot 10 civilians in various incidents, and now federal prosecutors have gotten indictments against many of them. And a doctor and two nurses stranded in a hospital with no power and limited supplies were charged with intentionally giving patients drug overdoses. Tonight at 9 o'clock, the PBS series Frontline investigates some of the police shootings in an episode called Law and Disorder. It's a collaboration of Frontline, the New Orleans Times, Picayune, and ProPublica. The correspondent is ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson, and he joins me now. Also with us is ProPublica reporter Dr. Sherry Fink. Her article on what happened in that hospital, titled The Deadly Choices at Memorial, was published last year in the New York Times Magazine, and it won her a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. Welcome to our show.
Thanks
for having me on.
A.C., what kind of environment was the New Orleans Police Department operating in during the storm's aftermath?
It's important to understand how crazy things were. The department didn't have a functioning communication system, and that's really a key thing for any first responder agency. They didn't have radios. The radio system and the computer-assisted dispatch system collapsed. And so basically the only ways to communicate were face-to-face in sporadic face-to-face meetings or via basically, they had kind of walkie-talkie level communications. If you and I were on the same block and we both had our radios, we might be able to chat back and forth. And that was it. And so in that situation, you had the normal command and control structure just fragment and collapse.
And it seems like they felt like it was total chaos. Much of the coverage in the press was about looting. How serious a problem was it? Were people stealing food or were they stealing TV sets?
People were doing lots of things. People were stealing to survive. There was no real organized relief going on, and so in many places. And so people were stealing cars to get out of the city. They were stealing bottled water trucks and driving them up on the interstate to give people water. People were also stealing opportunistically to take whatever they felt like taking that they didn't have before. So both things were going on. The thing that I think really helped catalyze a very militant response from the police force was the shooting of Officer Kevin Thomas by men who were trying to rob a gas station. And the police department really kind of adjusted its posture and started going after people who were breaking the law rather than rescuing and searching for people.
And we get in the show, we get conflicting reports as to whether officers were authorized to use deadly force against looters, whether martial law had been declared.
Right. And you know, we published a story yesterday, all three organizations, a print story, where we have now pinned down that we have a captain on the record who's gone to the FBI and said Deputy Chief Warren Riley gave that order to shoot looters who were unarmed, he perceived it to be unarmed, unthreatening looters.
And didn't he deny that on camera in your show?
Yeah, Warren Riley denied that on camera. He denied it in a follow-up interview. But we have a captain who said to the FBI, which is more serious than us, said, "Hey, this is what Warren Riley said."
Sherry, what were conditions like in the hospital?
Well, they were awful and far from anything that anybody there had ever been used to practicing in. The power went out very early on. It got very, very hot. The normal machines that support life were not, they weren't functioning. The waters came up. People panicked. It was also very chaotic. And again, the lack of communications, normal communications didn't work. And even the hospital leadership wasn't sure what the rescue plan was and when would the helicopters be coming. And so,
and how long did it take for help to finally arrive?
Well, help arrived quickly but slowly, and you can't evacuate an entire hospital with a couple hundred patients and then hundreds of staff, families, friends, even dogs and pets in a short amount of time with helicopters, with a couple of high water vehicles. So the help arrived quickly, but then it kind of stopped and slowed down while the rescuers focused on people who were trapped on their rooftops. And people in the hospital grew more and more desperate.
What happened to the doctor and the two nurses who were charged with murder?
Well, they were arrested, and an indictment didn't come. They were never charged and never spent any time in jail, but they were arrested. And just the fact that three well-respected medical professionals were arrested, it sort of set off a real backlash amongst people in New Orleans in particular, because these people were, in some sense, they felt scapegoated for all of the failures in Katrina.
If they had simply abandoned patients, would they have faced any charges?
That's an interesting question. No, I don't think they would have it. But I think that the choice here wasn't really between abandonment and mercy killing or hastening death, which some of the doctors who I spoke with said that they intentionally did. These people, again, as AC spoke about, there were a lot of rumors about what was happening in the city. And maybe some people felt, maybe some medical professionals felt, I have to flee for my life. But others felt, no, there's not looting going on here. We're okay. We can stay as long as we need to care for these people.
Well, let me throw this out to both of you. Should the same rules that apply during normal times apply under extreme conditions?
You know, from a police perspective, this is the deal, is that all of their training, all of their work, all of the time spent drilling, spent talking over the rules of engagement, talking about how they do their jobs, that's when it matters, is when you have a crisis. The day-to-day stuff, when you've got a kitten stuck in a tree, when you've got a shoplifting incident, minor stuff, it's not about then. It's about the crisis moments. And that's when you really hope that the training kicks in and that the discipline, that what's been drilled into these officers kicks in. And unfortunately, what we found is really that the officers slipped back into really bad behavior that had been kind of an undercurrent in the department for many years.
Were there contingency plans in place for dealing with a disaster? Sherry, what about at the hospital?
Well, this is a very active area of debate in medicine right now, because we had things like the avian flu scare and the H1N1 scare, Katrina. It's made people in the medical profession wonder, do we need different standards for disasters? And there are people who say that disasters, just as AC said, it's a time where all of the principles, the firmly held principles of medical ethics, need to apply even more, because because that's when we face the greatest dilemmas. But there are others who say we need to realistically look at how do we apportion care when the need is far greater than the resources that we have on hand. And unfortunately, a lot of those discussions are taking place really behind closed doors, and they're coming up with very different answers to those questions about who would be let into a hospital in a disaster. Could people be taken off of life support against their will? These are some of the things that actually in New York State has a protocol that allows for things like that. And unfortunately, the public hasn't been brought into the conversation, because these are really difficult things to contemplate and difficult things to think about and talk about.
My guests are two people who write for ProPublica, Dr. Sherry Fink and also A.C. Thompson. We're talking about what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, the chaos that has been underreported, actually. In the case of the hospital, Sherry, how does one decide how to allocate limited resources?
Well, it's tough. And
are there guidelines in place?
Well, there are different states, even the Veterans Affairs hospitals all over the country. They have a plan in place. New York, many other states have been adopting plans or kind of coming up with draft guidelines. And there is one very troubling aspect to some of these plans, which is that some of them include categorical exclusion criteria, or criteria by which patients could be taken off of life support against their will or without their consent. And some really interesting research has come out in the last few months suggesting that these guidelines, which aren't based on a lot of research, if they had been applied, for example, in H1N1, a number of hospitals have gone back and said, what would have happened if we had excluded patients based on these criteria? And what they found was 60 to 70% of the patients who would have been taken off of life support or excluded actually survived with care. So that just gives us the sense that we need to really look more closely at these guidelines that are on the books in certain states and do more research or have more discussion about what they mean.
But so much of this involves second-guessing the judgments of people who stayed at their posts to help others. They could have fled, and I'm sure some of the people in the hospital and some of the people in the police force did go.
Well, I think
was the staff mostly in place at the hospital?
Yes, they were. And I think after Katrina, one of the sort of responses to the arrest of those health professionals is a push for laws that would help protect health workers who do stay and sort of give them some civil protections and even protections against criminal prosecution in some states.
AC, in the days after the storm, there were many reports of violence that turned out to be false, like rapes and murders in the Superdome, snipers firing on rescue workers. Was there actual violence going on, leading people to be more fearful than they normally would be?
You know, there was some violence going on, and I've reported on that. You know, I did stories about white folks in a predominantly white neighborhood attacking African-Americans, and a man has been indicted for shooting somebody in that neighborhood for one of those crimes.
So these are vigilante crimes. This is not the police.
Vigilante crimes. There were crimes going on. However, the thing that seems important to note is that we know of one police officer being shot, and we know of 11 civilians being shot by police officers. And it seems like if there was as much gunfire as we were hearing about at the time from citizens, from crazed, wild citizens, that more cops would have been shot, more first responders would have been shot. And now when you go back and you talk to people like Eddie Compass and Warren Riley, you know, the people who were at the top of the police force at the time, a lot of people will tell you, you know, those stories that you were hearing about gunfire and about people shooting at helicopters and stuff, we now kind of think that, one, they were overblown, and that, two, some of that was people shooting out of their attic, trying to get out of their houses so they didn't drown, and two, trying to get the attention of rescuers, not scare them off, but get the attention. And so definitely the bulk of this was overblown.
Sherry, were people in the hospital afraid that they'd be attacked or that the hospital would be looted for drugs and stuff?
They were very afraid about that, and I did speak with some police who came out from a nearby police station on a boat to check out some of those rumors and didn't find them to be founded. It actually didn't happen at this hospital, but people were scared. They could see some people who were seeking shelter breaking into a building across the street from the hospital, and so there were fears. And one of the doctors who told me that he intentionally hastened the death of some of the patients, the very sick patients. He said he did it because he felt if I leave them here, then the animals from outside are going to come in and kill them and rape them after we health workers leave. So that was his reason for hastening deaths.
AC, the word rumors appears constantly throughout the Frontline show.
Right, right.
Everybody blames rumors.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's interesting. Some of these top officials now, everything that they were going on was rumors at the time, and they heard rumors about this and that. And partially they were hearing rumors, and they'll cop to saying, you know, I spread disinformation or misinformation unknowingly. And some of them will say that. But at the same time, there's some big accountability pieces that I don't think have been dealt with. You know, Eddie Compass, who was the chief of police at the time, told us that he never heard about the six people being shot on the Danziger Bridge, which was a major incident at the time for which officers have now been criminally indicted. You know, it was a very, very serious thing. And let me tell you, in policing, it's very rare under any circumstances that officers shoot six people in a single incident. And so when you have the top cop telling you, oh, I didn't know anything about that, you know, nobody seems to have known anything about that. It doesn't ring true.
My guests are A.C. Thompson, who is the correspondent who reports on tonight's Frontline show called Law and Disorder, a collaboration of Frontline, the New Orleans Times, Picayune, and ProPublica. It'll be broadcast 9 o'clock tonight on Channel 13 here in New York. And also with us is ProPublica reporter Dr. Sherry Fink, whose article on what happened in the hospital is called The Deadly Choices at Memorial. It was published last year in the New York Times Magazine and was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. We will continue after this. We're back with Pulitzer Prize winner Dr. Sherry Fink and with A.C. Thompson of ProPublica, who is the chief correspondent in a frontline investigation of police shootings in New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina hit. The show is called Law and Disorder, and it's being broadcast tonight. A running theme throughout tonight's Frontline episode is the case of Henry Glover, A.C. What happened to him?
You know, when I first started investigating Henry's death, all I had was this one brief statement by somebody who said, on September 2nd, 2005, I tried to rescue a man who'd been shot. I didn't know who shot this man. I put him into my car. A couple more people got in the car. We sped him to a spot where police were camped out. We thought the police could help him, that they could give him medical attention. But instead, the police physically attacked myself and my companions, and they let the man, whose name was Henry Glover, bleed to death in the back of my car. And it goes on to say this statement, that the next time I saw my car, it was burnt up behind a police station on the banks of the Mississippi River, and Henry Glover's ashes and bones were in there, and I believe the police burnt him up.
How long after Hurricane Katrina was this body finally discovered?
You know, the body was found, we think people started seeing the body, you know, shortly after that, you know, that pretty soon after September 2nd, people started seeing the body, taking photos of the body, taking videos of the body. A couple weeks after that, it was taken to the morgue. And at first, we didn't really know much about what happened. What has come out over the last 3 years is that the federal government now says that Henry Glover was shot by a police officer. They say that this second group of police officers physically assault Henry Glover's companions, the people who tried to rescue him. They say that police officers set his body on fire and set the car on fire. And they say that more police officers tried to cover this all up and lied to federal investigators. And it appears that the people who tried to rescue Henry didn't realize he'd been shot by an officer, and they sped him into the arms of other officers who then didn't help him. So five officers, current and former officers, have been charged with felony crimes. One is facing murder charges for the shooting. And this is a very big, very disturbing story, especially in New Orleans.
One of them had been lauded early in the press as a hero for other actions.
And that's the complexity of the Katrina time period. Dwayne Sherman, who was a lieutenant on the SWAT team at the time, undoubtedly did many, many heroic things. He went out and took his personal boat and rescued untold numbers of people. He went and saved people's lives, and that's a beautiful thing. The incredibly shocking and disturbing thing is that the federal government is saying that, hey, he's the guy who burnt up this poor man's body and tried to cover this up, and they're saying he physically attacked these guys. And when I interviewed the people who said they'd been beaten, they said, it was Dwayne Sherman, and he beat the hell out of us. He beat us very, very severely. Lieutenant Sherman also was involved in a shooting where an apparently unarmed man was shot repeatedly with an assault rifle. So, you know, we have these guys who did these amazing things. Men and women did amazing, heroic things, and also did very disturbing and, frankly, sickening things.
Do you think it was because of stress? Henry Glover was shot by the first policeman because of looting. Then, as you say, when his brother and a friend brought him to the police, they were handcuffed and beaten instead of treated with any kind of respect. You get the feeling the cops were just overworked and were overreacting to everything.
You know, There were lots of stressors for officers, and when we talked to them, they would say, we were freaked out about Officer Thomas being shot in the head. We were freaked out about seeing fires. Like, there was a shopping center that caught on fire. About hearing all these stories, we were totally drained and depleted. We didn't know where our families were. We didn't know if our families were alive. You know, two of our fellow officers committed suicide. It was a horrible time. Beyond that, though, there is a deep, deep culture within the New Orleans Police Department of looking the other way when officers behave badly. And Officer Sherman, Lieutenant Sherman, is a good example of that. He had more than 40 citizen complaints against him over the years. These were serious complaints, and yet he never was really disciplined. He was involved in which any expert on law enforcement will tell you is an extremely high number. Most officers never fire their weapon. And it doesn't appear he got retraining or was directed in any way to, hey, you know, maybe you shouldn't fire your weapon so much. So these are the kind of things that you're dealing with there even before you get to Katrina and this time period. You know, Lieutenant Sherman was sued and the city settled at one point because he allegedly ordered cavity searches on a baby, her mother, and her grandmother without good cause. And so we're talking about a deep culture of dysfunction there.
And the blue wall of silence isn't just something the police do. You get the feeling that it goes throughout the whole criminal justice system. The coroner's office, for example, seems to be complicit.
You should talk to Sherry about the coroner's
office. I was just about to.
We've both had some very, very interesting experiences with them. In our matter, you know, you have this situation where Henry Glover is found burnt up in a car, and he's so burnt up that there's almost nothing but ashes and a few bone fragments. And the out-of-state doctors who came in to deal with all the flood victims, one of them was dealing with Henry's remains and said, oh, this clearly looks like homicide to me. And he told the local coroner, hey, this looks like a murder. You need to deal with this. And what we know is that the coroner then basically did nothing. He didn't classify the death in any way, spontaneous combustion, suicide, homicide, accident. And he didn't tell the police or the FBI, hey, this is suspicious. I don't have enough information, but you got to check it out because people just generally don't burst into flames like that. And so it looks like he just either dropped the ball or didn't want to deal with it.
My guests are A.C. Thompson and Dr. Sherry Fink of ProPublica. We're talking about some of the chaos and anarchy that occurred in official circles in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Sherry, what are your coroner stories?
Well, Frank Mignard, he's a blue-eyed, twinkle-eyed, 80-something man who's been in that elected position for decades. And so he really has his own law, and he runs that office how he feels he should. And when it came to this case of doctors and nurses being accused of having hastened deaths after Hurricane Katrina, he went with what he felt was best for his city. And he said that. He said, "I sometimes you make a decision based on the science, and sometimes you have to look at the larger picture and how would it affect the city if I called these deaths homicides?" And so he came out publicly, and a few months before even the grand jury met to look at the cases of the health professionals who'd been arrested, and he said publicly, well, I don't yet have enough evidence that there was homicide here. Homicide is simply, when a coroner states it, it just simply means that the actions of one person led to the death of another. It doesn't have anything to do necessarily with legal responsibility. But he really didn't want to go that far. And even after my story came out and one of the doctors who hadn't been arrested just came out and said, I did this, I hastened to death. And the district attorney asked the coroner to look at that death and possibly reclassify it. The coroner came out and just said it's undetermined. And he said, even if the doctor thinks he might have killed that person, well, I can't prove it.
What about what was happening in hospitals in general? Do you know whether other doctors and nurses were taking matters into their own hands? Because in your hospital article, two other physicians admitted that they hastened the deaths of very sick patients, but they were not charged later with murder.
That's right. They weren't. And I think looking at other hospitals is very interesting for comparison and what can we learn about what leads one group of health professionals to feel that really hastening death is the only right thing. And these people really defended their decision. They felt that it was right. They felt that these people, that this was doing the right thing for these very sick patients. Whereas in other hospitals, with even more patients. One example is Charity Hospital, which was the big public hospital there in New Orleans. There were more patients, and there were many fewer deaths than at this hospital. And one of the things I've been looking at is what were the differences there, and perhaps there were some different aspects of leadership in the two hospitals.
Or hospital culture.
Mm-hmm.
You've come to no conclusions?
Well, I think one thing that we don't think about enough when we think about these awful decisions that, you know, yes, these can arise in disasters, in hospitals, who gets what care when care is limited. But I think in some places, and what's important to think about is both preparedness and being able to handle those situations without having panic and having plans beforehand, and also just a lot of really good improvisation in the moment and, you know, constantly looking at what are my resources, what are my needs, how can I best meet those. And there are some examples of that in recent disasters. In India, for example, when H1N1 hit, it really did overwhelm the medical system, and they really did have very few ventilators, very few ways to support very, very sick children, and more children than usual were impacted by that flu season. And there's one case where a pediatrician was able to just use a very cheap apparatus that's usually used to help babies breathe. She applied it to a whole bunch of older children and helped to save their lives when they had shortages. So it's not always about making these awful decisions. Sometimes you can find ways to expand care, even in the most horrific circumstances.
Although, AC, with the police, we don't hear too many positive stories. What are some of the other cases concerning the NOPD that the FBI is investigating, like Keenan McCann?
Yeah, Keenan McCann was the gentleman who was shot by Lieutenant Dwayne Sherman and by Captain Jeff Wynn. And he was with his family on the elevated I-10 freeway near the Superdome when officers got a report that people had stolen water trucks, bottled water trucks, and they were raping, killing, stealing from people. They were using the trucks to lure people in and then victimize them. And Keenan was apparently mistakenly shot 3 times with assault rifle rounds by Lieutenant Sherman and Commander Wynn, survived that miraculously. And what we found in looking at this is the department really didn't look closely at whether this was a good shooting. Was this appropriate? The story the police had was Keenan had a gun. The problem was Keenan didn't have a gun. There was no gun found anywhere near him. And when we interviewed his family, who were all with him, his mom, his stepfather, his brother, his sister-in-law, they said, really? Do you really think Keenan would have been on a crime spree with his mom in tow, raping, robbing, and holding people at gunpoint? But the department never really examined, hey, was this an appropriate use of force?
Well, NOPD officials have said that given the extreme conditions in the wake of Katrina, it was impossible for the police department to conduct thorough investigations of the shootings.
Yeah, you know, and that's partially the case. The crime lab wasn't working then. The crime lab was underwater. The evidence room was underwater. The jail was underwater. And people were left in it, by the way, when it flooded. But beyond that, these investigations went into 2006, 2007. They went on and on. And even when things started returning to more normal conditions, you know, at least semi-normal conditions, you didn't have the normal stuff that you should do. For example, in one of these shootings, Danny Brumfield, who was shot by an officer and killed in front of the convention center, the homicide detective looking at his death didn't bother to read the autopsy report. And she didn't know that he'd been shot in the back, which generally when people are killed is a significant fact because it generally means that they are not posing a threat to the person who's just killed them.
Hadn't he been trying to flag down officers for help?
Exactly. His family says, look, he was trying to get the police to stop and help him. And, you know, something happened and he ends up being fatally shot with a shotgun blast to the back. But for the detective to not even read the autopsy, that's, you know, and this is in 2006. We're not talking about the week after the storm. We're talking about in the middle of 2006. That is simply policing that would not fly anywhere else in the United States of America.
The Danny Brumfield case doesn't make it into the show. Frontline has posted other cases on its website, frontline.org. Were there just too many police incidents to include in a one-hour documentary?
that would be the case, that we shot dozens and dozens and dozens of interviews and then only got to use a relative handful of them.
Sherry, what happened to Dr. Anna Poo's campaign to pass legal protections for medical workers in a disaster?
That succeeded, and Louisiana has three laws that help to protect medical professionals, both civilly and also even from criminal prosecution. Now there's prosecutors are asked to wait for the results of a medical panel to let them know whether they think that the actions were medically appropriate before they pursue prosecution.
I could see that as a slippery slope.
Well, it's a difficult discussion. There are many health professionals who've been fighting for more reforms, more protections for, even general medical care. So this is an area of great concern for health professionals. And when Dr. Poe was arrested, they really capitalized on this idea that health professionals in disasters are vulnerable. And so this is one area of legislation where there's a lot of public support for protecting them, saying that how can we expect them to show up for disasters if they feel like they might face lawsuits. And indeed, there are still lawsuits ongoing against mostly hospitals and hospital corporations for poor preparedness from the family members of people who died, for example, when the power went out. And, the hospital had known for years that they needed to move their electrical systems above flood level in a city that's below flood level. So there are some very interesting liability questions that are coming up. And I should say that I think one of the very big vulnerabilities of our American medical infrastructure is that many hospitals are at risk of losing their auxiliary power systems in a disaster. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed on a national level.
AC, you mentioned vigilante shootings. Were those incidents properly investigated?
From my reporting, I don't believe that local law enforcement ever did any investigation of those incidents. That's my belief. And, in one of these cases, the most prominent one, Donnell Harrington, who was shot in the throat and nearly killed, he was in Spike Lee's first movie in 2006, and he was talking about his story there. And the chief of police at the time, the mayor, all these people went to the premiere and watched Donnell tell his story. Donnell actually appeared on the radio at about the same time Ray Nagin did and talked about this with him. But nobody ever investigated. I investigated. The FBI investigated, and the FBI put together a case. But, yeah, until the feds got involved, there was no real interest in this.
Thank you both so much. Frontline show, collaboration of ProPublica, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and also and Frontline itself is called Law and Disorder, and it's being broadcast tonight at 9:00 on Channel 13. We've been speaking with AC Thompson, who is the chief correspondent from ProPublica, and with Dr. Sherry Fink, whose article on what happened in the hospital where people were died as a result of the being stranded. It was published in the New York Times Magazine last year, won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.